Hello and welcome to the AFPAC File, a joint bi-weekly podcast of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in the Wilson Center, focusing on Pakistan and Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia in Washington, D.C. President Trump's administration has recently appointed a special envoy for reconciliation in Afghanistan. He is Zalmay Khalilzad, no stranger to the country as U.S.'s first ambassador in post-Taliban Afghanistan. The decision came in the backdrop of recent momentum involving peace talks with the Afghan Taliban to achieve a negotiated settlement to the Afghan conflict. While all this is happening, the Taliban has just appointed its five former commanders who spent over a decade at Guantanamo Bay to run its peace negotiations based out of its contact point in Qatar. The question is, how significant is the recent momentum? What are the challenges and opportunities? And what are the prospects for a possible breakthrough in peace talks with the Taliban? To discuss all these with me, I have an all-star panel. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is Marwin Weinbaum, director of the Middle East Institute's Pakistan in Afghanistan programs, Michael Kugelman, senior fellow at the Wilson Center's South Asia programs, Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you.
Great to be here.
Very nice to have you. So let's start with this week's news about the appointment of five former Taliban commanders and the former Gitmo prisoners to the Taliban's contact office in Qatar. Abu Bakr, how significant is this in terms of Taliban's view of peace talks?
Well, I think we have to really be very thoughtful here, and I think very pragmatic and practical. We have to understand that for the past 8-10 years, people have been talking about talking to the Taliban. So far, there is nothing that we can call talks with the Taliban. Of course, Western diplomats, including Ambassador Khalilzad, have met Taliban representative, but this is again talks about beginning some kind of talks in Afghanistan. We have had institutions dedicated to beginning these talks or conducting these talks, namely the Afghan Peace Council, which has been around since 2010. So the appointment of these five individuals is, in my view, is nothing like really groundbreaking, because the overall Taliban strategy in Afghanistan doesn't seem to be centered or focused on a negotiated solutions. The Taliban think that they are winning the war militarily. And of course, these figures are not known for being like seasoned diplomats or champions of peace causes. They were all military commanders picked up from the battlefield in 2001. Yeah. And then, of course, they were released a part of this kind of confidence-building measure. The Taliban violence continues unabated. It is increasing. And in recent times, the Taliban appears to be systematically eliminating some of their key Afghan military opponents, people like General Abdul Razak, lawmaker Abdul Jabbar Kahraman, and just yesterday, Farid Bakhtawar. So my overall prognosis about peace talks in Afghanistan is unfortunately not very positive.
That's a very interesting point. Marwin, maybe your thoughts on this, especially with the names. Does this ring bell in any way? Like, those commanders are Muhammad Fazil, Muhammad Nabi, Khairullah Khairkha, Abdul Haq Wasiq, and Nurullah Nuri. What does it say to you?
Well, I think that Abu Bakr is absolutely right. If you really want to have serious negotiations, you have to ask yourself, are these the kind of people that you would have around? These are military types, and we also don't know to what extent they represent what the thinking is among the core leadership of Al-Qaeda and of course,
Taliban.
The Taliban and the Haqqani network, especially with someone like Sirajuddin in charge of the military operations. So it's very questionable about what they're in a position to negotiate. I would not take their appointment there very seriously. I think that, generally speaking, what we're looking at here is the fundamentals have not changed. With Khalilzad's appointment, we have here is an indication of the fact that there's higher priority now being given, or in fact, even an urgency to try to reach some kind of settlement, even if in the process, Kabul has to be offended to some extent. But the real question here is what the Taliban and Haqqani network are ready to do. And as Abu Bakr points out, as far as they're concerned, things are very much going their way. The ingredients thus for some kind of just to get the talks started, never mind whether they could actually reach some concrete agreement on anything, which is an entirely different matter. That's really not what is at issue right now. What we're seeing here is some kind of shadow boxing by both sides.
Let me get also, Michael, your point. Like Marvin and Abu Bakr, they are not really excited about these changes in the Qatar office is going to make any difference. And they are also in the belief that Taliban thinks that, you know, they are winning. Peace talk is not really a priority, at least on this stage. So then by the appointment of Ambassador Khalilzad, what kind of message is the United States is trying to give here?
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you, Mohammed. And it's great to be here. I just want to say, I think this is now the fifth edition of this new joint podcast that we're doing. It's great. Jump right into your question. Unfortunately, I should say that I am also somewhat of a pronounced skeptic when it comes to prospects for Taliban reconciliation. And then I agree with what Marvin and Abu Bakr have said, that we shouldn't overstate the significance of these recent developments. But I will say this, you know, there have been some unprecedented developments that have arisen over the last few months that, you know, one could argue, if you want to be optimistic, that there could be a bit more cause for hope that something could get started. You have to go back a bit more than we've discussed time-wise and go back to that very brief but nonetheless still existent truce that the Taliban agreed to for a few days during Eid. I guess it was back in June. And then, of course, we now know that Kabul, at least for now, has formally signed off on the idea of the U.S. directly negotiating with the Taliban. And of course, that's always been a major precondition for the Taliban to agree to talks. And, you know, the thing with Khalilzad, to me, that suggests more than anything else to this point that this U.S. government, that the Trump administration is really serious about trying to make efforts to launch a peace process. They appointed him expressly for the purpose of trying to launch a peace process in coordination with Kabul and others. So that's significant. But yes, at the end of the day, you know, I have to agree with my colleagues here that two simple matters. One, the Taliban simply does not have any reason to stop fighting when it thinks it's winning the war. I mean, it's a simple but basic reality right there. And the other thing, you know, I would assume that if the Taliban were to actually agree to stop fighting and start talking, it would demand pretty significant concessions right off the bat from the U.S. and from Afghanistan. And the question is, what would they demand and what would the U.S. and Afghanistan be willing to provide? Those basic realities suggest to me that despite these recent developments with the Gitmo 5 joining the Qatar political office and other things, the release of Mullah Baradar, I don't think we should overstate the significance given that the bottom line realities remain the same and that it's going to be very difficult to jumpstart a peace process that the Taliban really seems to not have that much interest in.
That's very interesting. So, Khalilzad, is he coming with something new?
But we really don't know, aside from the fact that if he has a certain degree of latitude, which has been given to him by the Kabul government. But it's very clear from some initial discussions that he's not trusted at this point by many, many in Kabul and elsewhere in the country. And so the feeling is about Khalilzad that, he's very much a personality, and he'd like to play the role that Holbrooke tried to play in the Balkans, well, in Afghanistan, but had earlier in the Balkans, and that somehow he could be the magician here who would deliver things. I tell you one thing that I think he does bring, and that is that he has a direct line to the President of the United States. And that means that when he speaks, he can therefore speak more authoritatively for where the U.S. government policy is at this point. So that's important. But just how much you can do with it is another matter.
Abu Bakr, you know, I realize that you are not really optimistic about Taliban's intention in peace negotiations, given that they think that they are winning. Can Khalilzad make any difference in this situation, given the Marwin's point that Khalilzad has a direct line of contact with the President of the United States?
Well, Khalilzad, I think, is one of the best people that the United States has to kind of head this kind of initiative. I mean, he's an Afghan born. He has a lot of contacts with all the Afghan players. He has a lot of respect in the country, definitely among the elites. And then he also knows the region well. So these are all things that should work for him. But I think it's not as much as what Khalilzad can or cannot do. I think it's also how do you see and how you realistically try to unpack the problem at hand. What Khalilzad approach might be, and or what some in the Washington think tank community or American academia or the American experts on Afghanistan, what a large number of them now suggesting is this kind of negotiated solutions. And I know that a lot of people have invested a lot of emotions into it. But I think, their overall approach is that we can have something like a bond too. Because the original bond process had a major defect that it left the Taliban, and then the Taliban again converted into an insurgency. And that's why we now have the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, the formal name of the Taliban, controlling half of the territory. I think that's kind of a very simplistic view. Again, these people will always pose the question that, if you don't talk to the Taliban, what is the alternative? Who's going to commit all the resources, all the money to fight the war against them, and for how long, and what will be the strategy like, and all these complicated questions. But I think that the problem is that the Taliban have, after 2014, have had a military momentum. And we should not forget they are a military movement, primarily. They're not a political movement. This is something I've done a lot for my research, for my book, but also coverage of Afghanistan. If you look at their literature, I follow their literature regularly. Their language is not one of accommodation. Their language is one of triumphalism. They think that they are winning the war. You have to also remind yourself that, of course, Taliban are limited to Afghanistan as far as we know them, most of their elements, but they are an Islamist movement. They want to make an Afghanistan that never existed. They want to make a pure Islamic Afghanistan. This is what they call the Islamic Emirate. And I feel that it will be a major, major challenge for Khalilzad to somehow come up with an accommodation where the Taliban worldview can change. We can hope for the best, but I don't see it happening.
You know,
Muhammad.
Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to weigh in brief, quickly on this Khalilzad question. You know, one thing that struck me ever since he's been appointed, you know, in conversations with folks in the U.S. government, is there seems to be a tremendous amount of faith being put in his efforts, his personal efforts to launch some type of peace process. And I think that's a bit problematic because, yes, he knows the terrain, he knows the region, he knows the people, but you know, he is a controversial figure, and certainly he's made a number of enemies in Pakistan based on what he said. So, you know, I think that's a bit striking and a bit risky that, you know, it's almost like there's this expectation that, you know, now that he's there, it's just a matter of waiting until things start falling into a place. But of course, we can all agree that's not going to be the case. And it's almost like the objective is simply to be able to say, okay, well, we've been able to bring some Taliban reps to the table. We've been able to have some conversations with the U.S. government. But I don't know if there's a broader plan or strategy for what to do beyond having what really have amounted so far to talks about talks.
Yeah, it's also a little bit confusing on my end too. Like, you know, I was reading just the Al Jazeera piece on this. They were saying that the fact that Mullah Brother was released from the Pakistani jail, it was requested by the Taliban when they had a meeting with Khalilzad. So Khalilzad delivered at least one thing. The other thing is about the strategy, the broader strategy. On one hand, yes, you have Khalilzad appointed for this specific position to reconcile with the Taliban or to raise this momentum of peace talks, about the peace talks. But on the other hand, I was reading comments made by the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, who was recently appointed, General Miller. His first message was to put U.S. forces in the offensive position. Perhaps training is part of that, but he's specifically mentioning that U.S. forces will be on offensive because Afghans are taking too much shots, not the soldiers, but also civilians. So it seems that they are not putting all the eggs in one basket.
Let me come in on this, because it's true that the terms of engagement here have been loosened, and they can take much more of the offensive, and we may see many more American casualties as a result. But you see the way in which the U.S. justifies this as it continues to press here for some way out, is to say, yes, we take the military offensive, but that's in order to get the Taliban to sit down at the table. So it's not with the idea in mind that we actually can win, but more that this is the route to get the reconciliation that we're after. Let me add something that Abu Bakr said. I think that's so important, that we recognize that the Taliban, until proven otherwise, have a different vision of a future Afghanistan. And that's really not compatible with the kind of constitutional, democratic, we think inclusive system that at least in theory the Kabul government is supposed to be all about. That being the case, I would say that if one would see peace talks occur and you actually want to see an agreement, there's a very easy way to do it. Indicate to the Taliban that they can pretty much have the state that they want. And tomorrow, they will be at the table. At this point in time, the differences here are really, in a sense, fundamental. And nobody really wants to address that, address the fact that the Taliban, it's hard to imagine that the Taliban would accept Abdullah or Ghani as a head of state, head of chief executive, or that they would be prepared to form a political party and compete in elections. But those are the terms on which they're being offered reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is that everything that they've always said has very openly said, this is not what we want.
Mm, thank you very much, Barwin. So I hear lots of pessimistic opinions about the future of peace talks with the Taliban. So where all this is headed? Can these talks lead to anything? Can we expect anything from these peace talks? Or it's a waste of time? We will continue talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the podcast. I'm joined by Marwin Weinbaum, director of the Middle East Institute's Pakistan in Afghanistan programs. Michael Kugelman is joining us, also from Washington, D.C., who is the senior fellow, deputy director of the Wilson Center South Asia program. Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Abu Bakr is joining us from Prague. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager in Washington, D.C. And we are discussing current status and prospect of negotiated settlement in Afghan conflict. So it's been years since talks about peace talks are on the table. On one hand, Taliban apparently engaged in peace talks, but on the other hand, they are expanding their territory. They are killing what they call their enemies, and they think they are succeeding. On the other hand, we see this desire, momentum from the international community to reach to some sort of a negotiated settlement to this Afghan conflict. Is this leading to anything, or it's a waste of time? Abu Bakr.
Well, I think any effort towards peace should not be considered as a waste of time. But what I think some of the things that we have not so far talked about, I think really the fundamentals of Afghan conflict. And one of the fundamental problems with the conflict in Afghanistan is the role of its neighboring states, primarily Pakistan. Pakistan, we all know, has been the principal foreign backer of the Taliban. The Taliban, most of the Taliban leadership still shelters in Pakistan. I mean, at minimum, if Taliban are not really, I mean, if for a moment we will say that Pakistan, Taliban are not any proxies, they are an independent Afghan movement or something, but Pakistan has an overwhelming influence on the Taliban. And from what we have seen in the past quarter century, the Taliban have been kind of one of the main actors that we can credibly say claim that they've been advancing Pakistani interests in Afghanistan. So we also have to think about, like, what are the interests of all these countries in moving in Afghanistan, and what are they doing to further those interests, and how they can be accommodated. I think one of the main problems with this approach to peace is that I think Pakistan is again being dealt as a secondary problem, and the problem, the principal conflict is seen as an intra-Afghan conflict and a conflict among Afghans, and I think that will not take us anywhere.
Mm.
So, Mohammed, to get to your question about, is this all worth it? I think that's an important question because, you know, there's a lot of skepticism, which you're hearing from us today, but you hear this, from a lot of others. But, you know, I think that it's the least bad option. And, as unrealistic as the idea of a peace process is, I think it's a lot less unrealistic than the other option, which is to try to step up the military campaign. I mean, it's become cliche to say that the war cannot be won militarily, right? We couldn't do it with 150,000 NATO troops on the ground at the height of the troop surge 6-7 years ago. So we certainly can't do it with 15,000 mostly U.S. troops there now. But, you know, clearly Abubakar makes a very important point about Pakistan. I think it's clear that, the U.S. efforts to try to figure out how to get Pakistan to be less of a problem in this whole state of affairs in Afghanistan have not really worked out that well. Though I would argue that the causes of the problems and the strength and insurgency, it's both. I mean, it's certainly Pakistan is obviously a big factor, given that it continues to provide spaces to the leaders of this insurgency. But, you know, you can't overlook the fact that the governance problems and the very weak government, you know, the drug issue in Afghanistan, this all plays into the strengths of the insurgency. So in my view, at least, I think we certainly need to highlight the Pakistan problem and try to figure out how to deal with it, though that's not very easy to do. But at the same time, acknowledge that if there were no Pakistan, that does not suggest that there would be no insurgency. Certainly, it may not be what it is now, wouldn't be as strong, but that's not to say that, what's happening now would not be happening. So I think it's important to try to take a broader view to the extent that that's possible.
If I can just jump in on Pakistan, that there's no question that back in the 90s, for example, Pakistan was really orchestrating just about everything that was going on in Afghanistan. The situation has changed, though. The Pakistan of today, although it can easily play a spoiler role, cannot, and this is where I think Washington frequently overstates the situation, Pakistan cannot deliver the Taliban on terms that the Taliban will not accept. We've learned, not even going back to the 90s, that it's one thing to prevent things from happening, quite another thing to make them happen. And so any thoughts that we haven't, and there are people here in Washington who say, if only you could turn Pakistan around, that would pave the road here to reconciliation. Well, I think everyone agrees Pakistan is part of the problem here, but it's not the solution as such. And I think we have to keep that in mind. And I agree also with the idea that let's not forget that this problem really has been, as much as anything, the failure of the Kabul government. The Taliban are as strong as they are as a default option for many Afghans. It's not what they want, but when they weigh the two, the government and the Taliban, it's not clear to many, many Afghans whether there's a clear choice between the two.
Abubakar, do you want to say anything on the Pakistan topic? Obviously, we want to move on, but...
Obviously, I think I want to add that, look, at the end of the day, the real solution to Afghanistan is to have an Afghan state that is capable of fighting all its enemies, foreign and domestic, and that can control and manage and govern its territory, that's acceptable to all Afghans, all these good things. But the thing is that what many Afghans are afraid of is that the international community, in its zeal of getting out of Afghanistan or in a way ending the Afghan war, might be willing to make extremely bad choices. And among these bad choices is some kind of a bad deal or whatever with the Taliban. I mean, we have to look into the details are, I think, very complicated, because when we talk about like the drug problems in Afghanistan, the Taliban also control part of their trade. They are not part of the solution by any means. And then when we talk about the mismanagement or whatever, I mean, you can blame the Afghan government, but who was financing the Afghan government? Who is still financing the Afghan government? Who has, I mean, an oversized influence over Afghan government? If you go to Kabul, a lot of Afghans will tell you that, look, I mean, this ministry is controlled by this and this person who is controlled to this, close to this and this government, and this government wants this, and this other government wants this. So it's very simple to, like, kind of wash our hands that Afghanistan is ungovernable. We have to kind of address this problem, but I think that the Afghans know very well, but I think they need a long-term commitment to build the kind of state that is needed to protect them. Without that, any kind of short term. This is one of the problems that in Afghanistan, the military campaign started without any political groundwork in October 2001. And then the bone came in December 2001. And then the bone process was obviously very defective. It left out the defeated Taliban. And then you have, again, all these debates, and this still goes on 18 years on, that, like, I mean, how much money we're going to spend, how much commitment, how much this. Look, Afghanistan is a state. It potentially has the resources to run itself, but the country needs long-term commitment and long-term help to overcome this. And one final point is that if the international community fails to help Afghanistan become a strong state, I think it will be paying the costs in future, because Afghanistan can once again revert into a global bastion for terrorist groups. If the Taliban can hosted Al-Qaeda in 1990s, who will gonna stop them again hosting some other militant groups or other international terrorists in the future?
Yeah, Afghanistan obviously needs lots of help, economic and otherwise. And of course, it needs, first of all, achieve stability to move forward. And how to achieve stability is the question we are talking about today. And coming back to the peace talks options, maybe, Michael, if you can please jump in here. I mean, are we exhausted all the talking points in this, or is there any hope, maybe some change of tactic, maybe we were talking about wrong things in these peace talks? Is there anything still we can do, or it is just out of option and we should move on to something else to end this conflict?
Well, if you ask someone in the U.S. government, particularly the State Department these days, that question, they will say, no, we simply haven't tried hard enough, and now we're going to try and we're going to work something out. There's a remarkably strong degree of optimism in there all of a sudden, which I think is not called for. I remain skeptical. I think I go back to what I had said earlier. I think there could only be a peace process that starts, in my view, if the U.S. and Afghanistan make some very major concessions right off the bat. I just don't see any other way, given the incentive structure for the Taliban, why the insurgents would want to stop fighting, right? I mean, as I'm sure was mentioned, they control more territory now than at any time in the last 17 years. You know, they could seemingly blow things up at will. And I think that, you know, one reason why we've seen this most recent upsurge in violence, including this attack on the NATO commander that, of course, killed General Razak instead. Yeah, they're trying to strengthen their position if there were to be potential talks. I think that's part of what they're trying to do there. So, you know, the U.S. and Kabul would need to make major concessions right from the top. What that would be, what the Taliban would demand, I don't know. But I just don't see any way under any circumstances, no matter the fact that you have a Khalilzad now, no matter the fact that one of the major Taliban preconditions for talks has been accepted, given that the U.S. is now willing to negotiate directly. Despite all that, I just don't see, given the dynamic, how things could really be conducive to starting talks. And that raises an interesting question as to what next. You know, the U.S. is clearly all in at this point to try to launch a peace process. But, you know, what happens a few months from now, a year down the road, if nothing is moving? Then what? And then that's when I think you have to start thinking about possible exit strategies. I do think that a unilateral U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is more likely than some may believe it to be, not today or tomorrow, but in the coming months.
Yeah.
May I suggest something here? That our very concept of what reconciliation is likely to be, if it ever occurs, I think that's wrong. Because what we have in mind here is somehow getting all the right people around the table and hammering out some kind of compromise. Undoubtedly, it would be some kind of power-sharing arrangement with stipulated conditions in the Constitution, perhaps. It's hard to imagine just what it would be, but it would be, in any case, compromise. I think that this concept is wrong. The idea that this is going to be settled, as I say, around a table in Doha or in Geneva, really not fully represent what's going on here. Neither side, I think, is unified enough to reach that kind of agreement. And I would also take some exception here of going back to Bonn, because the idea that somehow we would have invited the Taliban to come in and share power after 7 years of the Northern Alliance fighting them, it just, in retrospect, it sounds like, wouldn't it have been a great idea if they were willing to to join this new government, but that really was never politically possible given the feelings that the Afghans had at that time toward the Taliban. So let me just add one more thing here, and that is that doesn't mean that you can't have reconciliation of another kind. And it's not the grand bargain, but it is the small bargains. And that can only come about, well, we call that the reconciliation process. And that can only come about when you have a government that is succeeding over the next few years with international assistance, and where you have deals struck with individual commanders and their fighters. There, you know, occasionally that sort of thing happens, and it has happened elsewhere in the world as a way to end a civil war. The conditions for that are not out there right now, but that is a way that politically you can have an outcome without having a grand bargain.
That's an interesting point you are throwing, Marvin, here. You are saying that these kind of negotiations would succeed only if there is a succeeding government. To achieve succeeding government, what kind of condition there has to be?
Right, and let me just add that something I've been arguing for a long time, and that is, therefore, what the international community, in particular the U.S. forces are there, is to buy time for the government to put its act together. Unfortunately, that's not happening right now, just to the contrary. But that's the way you can justify the international communities being there, saying that if they can then regain the confidence of the people and thereby peel off the insurgents who are not diehard ideologues here, then that gives you a slow process. It is a slow process toward real reconciliation.
But then you also hear the other argument against this idea, whenever a discussion starts on Afghanistan, the first word, it's the longest U.S. war ever. So how long it can continue? How long the support can continue?
That's an important point, because could make the argument that eventually, if it's not this year, next year, we run out of patience. The Congress, and it's not a partisan issue at this point, and that's important. The Congress, the American people, and certainly the president in his inclinations here are to somehow end this war. I think that's very true. But there's a sweet spot here, and that is that if the U.S. has a minimal commitment, enough stability so that this government can continue for another 5 years, if with just 15,000 and a far less financial commitment and body bag commitment than we've seen, that this could go on for some time as long as the commitment is kept in that sweet spot where it's enough to keep stability going, but not enough to so disturb the American public and the administration that it feels it has to move out.
Okay, so over time, we need to end the discussion very quickly. Abu Bakr, just one final point from your end. I mean, it's been 17, 18 years since this conflict started with the involvement of international community there. I mean, it has to end. So if you were to choose a solution, options, what that would be? If not the peace talks, then what? What are one or two options that you think would bring solution to this issue?
Look, the Afghan people have clearly chosen a solution, and the solution is that they want to be part of the modern world. In the recent election, however flawed, however mismanaged, I think more than half of the Afghan electorate, out of 8.8 million, more than 4 million people, or maybe as many as 5 million people, voted. Despite threat, despite Taliban killing a lot of civilians, security forces, we are probably going to see a much younger, educated parliament this time around in Afghanistan. So, I mean, nobody can deny or state faces. But, I mean, for Afghanistan, you have to, have a strong Afghan state, and then you have to think of ways how to strengthen it. I think on the Taliban reconciliation, I agree with Marvin that it has to be, the Taliban can be reconciled in a small way, or maybe they can be reintegrated. We have many successful cases of our former Taliban leader becoming governors or local commanders and all that. But if they don't have foreign support, they don't have the kind of support and sanctuary that they have in Pakistan, I think it would be much easier to deal with them and much more cheaper to deal with them. So if America's longest war is failing or has failed, It is not because of what has happened in Afghanistan. It has because of what has happened in the region, primarily in Pakistan. I think we have to find answers to those questions and not, I think, just advocate kind of phony solutions and phony end states.
Okay. Michael, final point from you. So this long conflict has to end. So what's the way to end it? Like, what path will lead us to this point? Peace negotiation, military, something else? What's that?
Honestly, I think the best we can hope for is that this political transition in Afghanistan will play out fairly effectively so that by April or May of next year, there'll be a new government, the product of an election, not a U.S.-led negotiation that will be seen by all Afghans, including the Taliban, hopefully, as a more credible government that would potentially be seen as a credible peace partner. I just don't see any way there could be any headway or momentum toward launching a peace process with the National Unity Government. It is simply discredited and regarded as illegitimate by many in Afghanistan, not only the Taliban. So I think that we have to look to next year. But time is short, particularly for the U.S. They want to move things along now. So tough days ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael. So you are saying that the key might be in the next elected government, the election of which is expected in April next year, I believe. So, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Michael Kugelman, Senior Fellow, Deputy Director of the Wilson Center South Asia Programs. Also, big thanks goes to Marwin Weinbaum, Director of the Middle East Institute's Pakistan and Afghanistan Programs, and Abu Bakr Siddiq, Editor of Freedom Free or Pride Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the AFPAC File, a joint podcast of Freedom Free or Pride Liberty in the Wilson Center. Please join us in the next discussion in 2 weeks. Until then, bye-bye.